From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Peter Rock's first encounter with the Church Universal and Triumphant came when he worked on a ranch in Montana. This was when the church was thriving there in the late 1980s. Their leader was this charismatic woman named Elizabeth Clare Prophet, and she would lead the believers in these mesmerizing incantations. Rock watched the believers as they built underground shelters and stored the supplies they would need for the end of the world that they believed was coming in 1990. Peter Rock has written a novel inspired by the church, but he doesn't ridicule them or their beliefs. The characters come from the interviews with the people who were among the faithful, and he's talked about his admiration for them. Peter Rock will be in Utah today. He's joining us to talk about his book. It's called The Shelter Cycle. After the news. This is Radio West, and Doug Fabrizio. In Peter Rock's new novel, The Shelter Cycle, Francine has long since left the New Age sect of her childhood. It was a church in Montana led by a charismatic woman who would lead the faithful in mesmerizing chants as they prepared for the end of the world by burying shelters deep in the ground. They had storage for coins. Paper money would be no good in this new world. And Francine was taught that she and her family were surrounded and protected by nature spirits and energy force fields. When Rock takes up the story, Francine is no longer a believer, not really, but she does long for something from that time. In fact, she describes it as the happiest time of her life. Peter Rock's novel is based on his own encounter with the Church Universal and Triumphant. He worked there on a ranch in Montana. This was the time when the church was thriving there in the late 1980s. And the characters come from interviews with people who were among the faithful. He's talked about his admiration for them. He's even been personally influenced, he says, by their commitment and their ideas. Peter Rock is going to be in Utah today to talk about his book. And today in the program, he's joining us. Again, the book is called The Shelter Cycle. You can join us if you like, if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Peter Rock is a professor in the English department at Reed College. He's a recipient of a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, the author of 5 novels. And he's joining us today from a studio in Portland, Oregon. He's going to be in Salt Lake, as I mentioned, this evening. There's doing a reading at the King's English Bookshop. We'll give you the details about that a little bit later. Peter Rock, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
I wanted to start, I didn't mention there in the introduction that you grew up here in Salt Lake City, a non-Mormon among the Mormons. If it's okay, I kind of wanted to start there because you've written about Mormonism before. Your novel, This Is the Place, you talk about it, and you've described your relationship to, I guess, religion generally, maybe particularly Mormonism, but as having been kind of developed in a kind of sense of resistance to religion. What did you mean by that? Kind of a resistance to, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think everyone who grows up in Utah, and I think it's probably still the case, but when I did, I feel like, you know, I spent a lot of time in Cub Scouts praying before Pinewood Derbies or praying before having my uniform examined. And I looked in the, you know, the Cub Scout guidebook and I felt like, where are all these prayers coming from? What is happening? And so I think as a child growing up in that culture, you're either a member of the church or you're not. And I think that influences everyone in different ways. But my friends who are not LDS and people in my family, I feel like is a hard thing to accept. So I think you do build up a fair amount of resistance or you think about spiritual concerns in terms of opposition. And I think the closer that you get to teachings often, the harder it is to feel quite so angry about it. And I think a lot of what I resisted when I was younger was more cultural than it was actually about beliefs. So yeah. When I wrote This Is the Place and I actually had to pick up the Book of Mormon and read the doctrine, I found it so fascinating. And, you know, it didn't convince me, but it did speak to me and resonate with me in various ways. So clearly, you know, when my students are working on writing something and they're attracted to history or they're attracted to factual information, I tell them, you know, there's something inside of you that is resonating with this, that you have to trust your curiosity and your intuition. Mm. And I never can tell what I'm writing or why I'm writing something, except later. And it's clear that growing up in Salt Lake influenced my curiosity about this church, and it sometimes is a church that I've heard described as Mormons on steroids,
right.
Where, you know, the beliefs are similar in some ways. The amount of time that they're prepared to be underground, you know, 7 years is, you know, or the amount of storage is greater. But I guess I would also say that I've been back, of course, to Salt Lake, and my parents still live there, and my brother lives there. And when I talk to high school students, I'm always so struck by whether or not they're LDS, how focused they are on spiritual concerns. Their writing is so aware of the invisible, or, you know, the pressure of the spiritual in that valley. Mm. And when I talk to high school students in other parts of the country, their focus or awareness, whether in opposition or in favor of spiritual concerns, is pretty much non-existent. So I feel like there is an atmosphere of vibration in the Salt Lake Valley that causes you to react in one way or another.
Well, we'll get back to this, spend some time with it maybe. But this was one of the – it seems like anyway, this was one of the takeaways from your experience learning about this church in Montana was – their sense of commitment, their sense of spirituality. And I wonder if you were surprised how personal it became for you in some way, how much you took it on yourself. Not the ideas, but something deeper there, some kind of spirituality.
I would say so. I mean, a lot of different things happened when I was working on this book, and I could talk about the further past of thinking about these people, but the one big thing that happened, you know, 5 or 6 years ago when I started thinking about the book was I realized that there was a student who was a young woman at Reed College where I teach, and she had been a child in this church.
Yeah.
And I didn't know her well, and she had graduated, but I contacted her, and she'd moved back to Bozeman. And I think one thing she was trying to do was to come to terms with her past and those beliefs. And she agreed to talk to me, and that led me into a whole series of, you know, 30 hours worth of interviews with different people. And I think in some unconscious way, I had a feeling that these were some people who did some crazy things and that I would mine that somehow and I would take advantage of it and turn it into a story. And then, you know, as is usually the case when you have a sort of fantasy about a group of people or an individual and then you start talking to them, it's quite different. And I found them both so intelligent and had such an interesting perspective and so funny about it, but also just, I guess, they had thought about and considered spiritual concerns in a way that I hadn't. Mm. And the first series of interviews I did, I felt sort of at sea because I felt that they were asking questions that I hadn't really asked or they had acted on belief in a way that I never would. Mm. But I also felt that I was just woefully unprepared to even talk to them. So I had to go back here to Portland and, you know, spend a year just reading the works of Elizabeth Clare Prophet and the I Am activity and all of these texts just to try to begin to understand how to talk to them. But I think another crucial thing in writing the book and in this period of time was I of course, never had children before. So I have two daughters now.
Yeah.
And they were both born during the time I was writing this book. And I think, of course, there's a sense that when you have children, you're responsible for teaching them or having answers or at least having worthwhile questions. And I felt that I'd sort of been skating across a lot of big questions in my life. And I think there's also a way in which having children for me made me less cynical or more open to thinking about these bigger questions. So I don't know. I mean, one of the real turning points for me in writing the book was I was interviewing a man who was an electrician, and it's not coincidental that a lot of the people I talk to are contractors because they came – either they had skills or gained them working on the shelters. Then they stayed in Livingston and Bozeman,
right,
making fancy houses for rich people. And this electrician was the first person I talked to who didn't disavow the teachings. And I would often say in interviews, well, you no longer believe these things, but do they return to you at any time or how do they affect you? And he said, what do you mean? Of course, I still believe all of this. And that was startling to me. But then a little while later in that conversation, he kind of reached across and grabbed me and he said, listen, you and I are not physical beings. We're spiritual beings and we're in these envelopes of flesh for a short period of time. And we're fortunate to have this conversation right now. And when he said that to me, I felt, I'm going to die. here in Montana. Something bad is going to happen to me, and I just had a child, and I'm following, you know, my curiosity into this stupid book. And then he let go of me. We talked for, you know, another couple minutes, and I thought to myself, as my heart slowed down, I thought, you know, that's not really so differently from how I would conceive of what we're doing here.
Yeah.
And that happened to me over and over again, where people said something that struck me as really bold but also really kind of ridiculous, and then I recognized that it resonated with me in some way.
You know, I have to say I felt that way reading the book, that and I'm not, I promise I won't give anything away, but I felt uneasy at times about this is going to end badly. This, something really nasty is going to happen. I wonder what's going to happen. So I felt on the edge there. I mean, in some way, maybe it's sort of like you felt for a time, at least, that this something bad's going to happen, and then you were surprised.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that makes sense to me. I think that one of the early intuitions I had about the book when I started thinking about the church, when people talk about the church universal and triumphant, they talk about it as a cult. And I never use the word cult in the book or when I talk about it typically, because some people would say, you know, the difference between a church and a cult is really a question of size. But it also is a question of control. But no one ever really says to you, I'm in a cult. That's not the way to empathize or sympathize with people or to think about their experience. And so I think there was a sense early on that the most obvious way to tell this story would be a parody or a critical take on the religion or making fun of it in some way or tearing it down. And I realized that a happy story would be perhaps more surprising, or to try to take it on its own terms, or to try to tell the story from inside these beliefs. And that was really easier for me to do than I thought, because so many of the people that I talked to were children at the time of the shelter cycle. And the shelter cycle really refers to a period of time,
right,
which is about, you know, 1986-87 through 1990. And their descriptions as being children in this church were so positive and so full of wonder, because they were given so much freedom to be out in this beautiful landscape and do all these things. They did believe that they were surrounded by these invisible nature spirits who were protecting them. And meanwhile, you know, they and their families and their community possessed a truth that no one else had, that they were doing work that was spiritual work that was going to make them better people and make the church stronger, but also save the world. And related to this, and not unimportantly, their parents were building these shelters, which were described to me, and I would agree because I've been in them, as the coolest forts in the world, far underground. And so they were, I mean, they had very ambivalent feelings about the church because their childhood memories were so wonderful and so positive.
You have talked about the way this book had kind of evolved as you were thinking about it, I guess even as you were writing it. I mean, you talk about how in the, I think it was the late 2009 or something, like you said, all right, I've got it. This is a book. I've figured this out. But then, I'm not sure exactly, but something happened, and then you went away from it for a time, and it seems like you figured this is not going to work. And then I guess it was like late 2011, you said it started to feel possible again as a story. What was the thing that got you thinking this may work again?
I think it was it just took time.
Yeah.
Part of, as I said, it took a lot of work to understand the teachings of the church enough to begin to write about them. Mm-hmm. And the book became so encyclopedic. I mean, as you know, the book now is just over 200 pages, but its first draft was over 1,000 pages.
Wow.
And I was trying to account for so many different fascinating things, and I still couldn't quite grasp it. And I said to one of my sources, you know, I feel like I'm getting close with the cosmology and the belief system, but it's so hard to fit it into my head. I don't think I'm smart enough. And he said, well, no one is smart enough. That's the point. We were always off balance because it kept changing and it kept growing. Mm. But everyone had their favorite ascended master or their favorite area of the teachings. And that was a way into it for me to figure out that I could simplify. I didn't ever add anything or exaggerate the teachings, but it's a pretty drastic simplification of what's happening. Mm. I think related to that was I spent so much time talking to people, and I had these intense relationships with the people I was interviewing. And the intensity, I would have to say, was mostly on my part, because I would talk to them for a couple hours, and then I would go back to Portland. I would think about everything that they had told me, and I would think about them all the time. And I felt like we were constantly in conversation. But when I would go back to Montana and talk to them, it was clear that it was a very minor thing for them to talk to me, and I felt like they were the most important people in my life, or some of them. And I think they were always just looking at me like, why are you so crazy? Why are you so intensely, you know, related to me in your mind, because our relationship is not that complicated. Yeah. And because of that, I think I had to spend some time away from talking to these actual people so my characters could become as real to me as these other people. And I wasn't aware when I was using real people's words or details from their lives, because that was a real distraction and a real complication. So it just took a lot of settling.
Yeah.
But I think it was a very, it wasn't a technical series of decisions so much as an emotional process that I had to go through. One of my sources said, the last time I went to Montana to talk to him, he said, you know, the first time you came here, you were very together. You were a young professor. You know, you had these great questions, and I was really impressed. And now it's like 4 years later, and you're a mess. You can't even put a sentence together. You're clearly not sleeping. I think you might be getting closer to actually being able to tell this story.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the story. I want to start with Francine. Young Francine, there's a section I want to have you read. This is very early on in the book. Mm-hmm. And there are, I guess they're journal entries, I suppose. Is that the way to put it? This is young Francine describing her experience then when she's a part of the sect, the church.
Right. So she's about 30 years old for the frame of the book, which happens in 2010.
Right.
And she's very pregnant, and some of the beliefs are coming back to her in various ways. And she's trying to make sense of her childhood and how she grew up. And so she's writing a document, which is a kind of letter. And it's really to herself, but also to her child. And so she's hoping to make some account for it. So this is right from the first page into the second page. And it's a description of Francine and her childhood friend Colville, who's an important character in the book, up above the shelters in the hills above Paradise Valley. High above, the aspen's leaves slapped, the blue sky bright between them. I listened to Colville's breathing, trying to match mine to it. My shoulder felt his shoulder, even though we didn't touch. I turned my head, his ear so close to my mouth. When I moved my fingers down along my side, they touched his, and we both pulled away. Eyes closed, we listened to the stream, its liquid sounds, the voices of Undine, the nature spirits who served water. I imagined all the elementals looking down at the two of us on our bed of green grass. They were the servants of God and man in the plains of matter, which is where we were living, where they protected us. The Undines in the water, and the spirits that serve the fire element called salamanders. Elementals of the earth were gnomes, those of the air, sylphs. The thoughts we had out in nature were actually the elementals making their wishes seem like ours. We built tiny homes for them, filled with quartz crystal in the little caves of the splintery cliffs. The elementals were part of the reason our parents let us play alone out there. Our parents, they had so much to do, so many preparations to make. It was fortunate for everyone that we had spiritual protection. What you are reading is the beginning of a letter. It is a letter to you, though I don't know when you'll be able to read it. It's also a letter to myself to remind me of those things I might try to forget. Like how it felt in those days when I was a girl, out in the mountains with Colville. Colville and I followed deer paths, and we had our own paths, too. We walked side by side, and then we went out in front with a stick in case of rattlesnakes. As we came over the ridge, a dry wind slipped around us, and we started down the other side. The sky was wide and everywhere, full of things we could not see.
That's Peter Rock reading from his new novel, The Shelter Cycle. Francine is 30 now. She's, as you said, she's pregnant, and she's thinking about that, about the sort of lovely moments of her past. As she says, as I mentioned in the introduction, the happiest time of her life, which she considers it all began to make sense, and she feels, I guess it's fair to say, Peter Rock, she's conflicted. She doesn't believe necessarily anymore, but there's stuff that she does believe. things that she had left, she had put aside for a time, I guess.
Yeah. I think, I mean, this was something that there were sort of two main threads that fascinated me early on in my interviews. And one was what I spoke of before, which was the incredible wonder and the happy memories that people had. And then the other was that so many of the people I talked to who were about 30 and whose families had left the church and left the beliefs behind, you know, 20 years before, found when they were in moments of stress, they would start chanting or they would start praying with prayers from the church. And they felt that there was this vestigial belief that they couldn't shake that was just maddening, that you know, made them angry that they couldn't get rid of it, but it made them feel better. And this is especially pronounced, I think, for a lot of people when they have children. And so this is where it was running parallel to my life, which is to say that the church's beliefs about pregnancy and about children are really complicated and interesting. But for instance, you can do things like when a child is in utero by, you know, chanting on various gems and doing different things, you can shift the DNA of your child and you can turn it into a different kind of person, you know, a more powerful person. And then when the baby is born, there are a lot of rules about who can hold it and who can touch its head and when that can happen. And there's a lot of attention paid to how to treat a child's first words and how to allow them to articulate what they need to say, because there's a fair amount of belief in reincarnation. So there's a sense that children are coming with a wisdom from higher planes and they're coming with a wisdom from their previous lives. And so often the first kinds of things they talk about, we correct them and we just sort of teach them how to behave and how to speak and how to understand things on our terms when actually we should be learning from them. Mm. So that's something I've been trying to put into play with my daughters, of course. And that's something that I wanted to write about because I was so aware of how strange it is to have a child. And clearly I've never carried a child, but I could just tell from my wife's experience that you know, the anticipation and the strangeness of bringing another person out of your body is, you know, something that, you know, there's no experience like that. So I was trying to, with Francine, maybe get as close as I could to that.
Peter Rock is with us. His latest novel is called The Shelter Cycle. He's going to be in Salt Lake City this evening for a reading at the King's English Bookshop. That's at 7 o'clock. You can get more details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer Peter Rock. He's with us to talk about his latest novel. It's called The Shelter Cycle, inspired by the true story of a Montana-based New Age sect called the Church Universal and Triumphant. Peter Rock uses the facts to weave a narrative that explores how memory and the past continue to shape us, even when we think we've left them behind. He is coming to Salt Lake. He'll be here tonight at the King's English Bookshop. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. He's joining us from a studio in Portland, Oregon. Let's talk about the character of the messenger in the book. She's built around Mother Claire, Elizabeth Claire Prophet, the actual leader of the Church Universal Triumphant. And when we meet her in the story, her days of glory are past. But she had an incredible hold on the faithful, on the believers. Talk about her, if you would. She was such a fascinating character.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there isn't really a person I can think of. And, I mean, whether or not she was a person is a question, I suppose. But if you were to go on YouTube and watch her decree, because she was the only person who was able to communicate with the Godhead of this church, the ascended masters, who were seven men who had once been people but had ascended into higher planes. And those ascended masters range from mystical figures like El Morya or Saint Germain, Paul the Venetian, to more familiar figures like Buddha and Jesus Christ. So the religion is really vast. And these masters spoke at a vibration that was so strong that it would just blow a regular person apart. And she was able to dictate their voices out to her followers, and in a way that was so eerie and so convincing. I mean, people often ask or wonder, you know, did she really believe this, or was she a master manipulator? And I think both of those things are kind of true, and maybe over the course of, you know, as she became more and more powerful, things became harder to understand. But there were other things, which I'll speak of in a moment, that were at play. The description of being in her presence by the people I talked to was so amazing, because they spoke of just this electrical presence of, you know, people would faint in her presence. She was so powerful. And if you watch her on YouTube, it's kind of, it's very mesmeric and very impressive. But like a lot of my studies in this church, it was interesting because it's kind of like going back to the 80s. So she has a series of pantsuits and a lot of shoulder pads and kind of mullety hair. And it's kind of funny, but she's so serious. And a couple times people said to me, because I was interviewing people during the election, and they would say, well, you know that power that you feel from Hillary Clinton, if you were to multiply that 3 million times, that was how forceful she was in person.
I actually have a clip.
Okay.
Is it okay? Can we play a little bit of her? You talked about the mesmeric quality. That's mm-hmm. This is her. It's a particular chant that you actually write about in the book. You know, I am the violet fire. And Francine talks about if we could balance the dark with our light, so much more would mm-hmm. be visible. The idea here is shifting the vibrations of the air. But let's play a little bit of Elizabeth Prophet, so you get a sense of, the quality of it. Because it's strange on one hand, but if you listen to it long enough, I guess, Peter Rock, it becomes mm-hmm. kind of – you can kind of put yourself in a trance.
Right.
Here it is.
I am a being of violet fire. I am the purity God desires. I am a being of violet fire. I am the purity God desires. I am a being of violet fire. I am the purity God desires. I am a being of violet fire. I am the purity God desires. I am a being of violet fire. I am the purity God desires. I am a being of violet fire. I am the purity God desires. I am a being of violet fire. I am the purity God desires. I am a being of violet fire. I am the purity God desires.
There's kind of a cycle to it, Peter Rock. I mean, it gets faster and faster.
It gets faster and faster. And as one of my sources told me, he said, you know, if you're in a room with thousands of people and you decreed like that for 4 or 5 hours is a much more powerful and surreal experience than putting a couple hits of acid on your tongue.
Can I play one more thing? Because this is a bunch of people.
Right.
And it's unintelligent. Let me just play a bit of that so people can get a sense of that acid hit, because it's really extraordinary. Yeah, it's wild.
Yeah, it's amazing. So I'll backtrack a little and talk a little bit more about the history of Elizabeth Clare Prophet, who was born in New Jersey. The church itself was founded out of or sprung out of a slightly older religion, which is the I Am activity, right, which still exists and mostly is operated in Chicago. And that church was founded by a man named Godfrey Ray King. And he was hiking at the turn of the 20th century in California on Mount Shasta, and he came upon Saint Germain, this right, mystical figure from medieval times, who gave him this strange white bubbling drink and a panther as a companion and led him on a series of adventures. But this is the idea of the Ascended Masters sort of sprung out of that church in America. And it's a very, you know, like Mormonism, a very old American religion, you know, old on American standards.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth Clare Prophet's husband, Mark Prophet, was the first messenger, who was the first person to dictate the messages of the Ascended Master in this church. And like a lot of interesting churches, it sort of was founded and found its power in Colorado Springs. And then in the 60s and 70s, they moved to California. And in 1973, Mark Prophet died. And she had started to dictate by then, but she became the messenger at that moment. And she was much more educated and much more charismatic than he was. And she made, you know, various claims of, you know, having been Joan of Arc or having been Marie Antoinette, having been Nefertiti, having been Guinevere. She had a pretty regal and important lineage. And to be in the community of Montana, she moved the church to Montana in 1983, I believe, in the early 80s. They bought a big ranch that was owned by Malcolm Forbes because she believed that the tectonic plates out here on the West Coast were significantly dangerous enough to move to a safer place. And to live in that community with her people, it was like living with Jesus Christ in a small community. It was just an amazing, amazing thing. And so one of the primary questions I had when I started out on this book was, how would it be to prepare for the end of the world, to build these shelters and to go underground and then to surface into this world that you didn't think would exist anymore? And would that crush your beliefs, or how would you continue to live in this world? And people had different answers for that. But when I asked them, you know, was that the end of your belief? They said, not really. You know, we felt like we had an impact on the potential apocalypse. We felt like the prophecy was not written in stone, and our preparations and our prayers and our decrees helped turn back that time that could return. But they said what really shook them was that Elizabeth Clare Prophet was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in the early 90s. And so, it, you know, some people think she was becoming more and more unhinged as the shelter cycle began, because it wasn't that violent or extreme a church until that period of time, or preparing for violence. And so a lot of the time when I was writing this book, she was still alive. She died in 2009. But the believers would tell me, well, Mother is no longer with us. Her soul has ascended, but her body is still here on earth. And so the church still exists, of course, but it's not focused in the same way, because no one could really step into her shoes, or no one could fill the power vacuum and become the messenger. So they say, you know, Mother left us enough teachings to last us for 5 million years. There's so much to go back to. So that's a lot of their focus now.
Yeah. Let's talk about Colville Young. Again, in that reading before, this is Francine's childhood friend, boyfriend is maybe not exactly the right word, but they were incredibly close, obviously. And Colville, now in the present time of your book, has come back into Francine's life. And Wells Davidson, who is Francine's husband, they live, Francine and Wells, in this small house in Boise. There's been a kidnapping of a young girl has disappeared from the neighborhood. And Colville Young has arrived. He feels like he needs to be there for a couple of reasons. I'm not sure how much I can say, Peter Rock, but I won't give away too much, but he's there. Let's just say that. And Wells Davidson, Francine's husband, is threatened by all of that. But Colville, who had left the church, I guess, for some time anyway, is coming back in some way, or at least wants to reconnect with some of the feelings he had, I guess, for the past. Talk about Colville Young.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I was so curious about how we react to the things that we learn when we're young. And when I was talking about my last book one time on the radio, a child psychologist called in and said, you know, the ways that we understand ourselves in the world and the way that we understand, you know, how the world works around us, that becomes kind of concretized when we're 11 to 14. And we can become more, you know, more sophisticated, but our general understanding of things typically doesn't change that much. And when your whole belief system is taken away from you when it has been established, I was just curious what different ways, and clearly my interviews guided me and showed me different reactions to these childhood beliefs. And Francine has really pretty much repressed them until this time of my book. And she has a life. You know, she's working. She's having a child. She's married. Her husband doesn't know that much about her past. He knows that she was in this church.
Yeah.
And Colville, on the other hand, doesn't have much of a life. And he's looking for direction. And he's feeling a kind of pull and a kind of energy. And he believes that he has been called to find this girl who's disappeared. And when he's out with the search parties looking for her, he sees Francine and he feels that they've been taught since they were children that coincidences are something that they don't really exist.
Yeah.
And so he believes he's been called to be in contact with Francine again, just at the moment when she's kind of ready to revisit her childhood or is starting to think about it again.
There's a section here I want to have you read. This is Colville keeps moving around from motel to motel to keep the dark forces and the spirits confused, as he says. It's like the messenger who keeps moving all night on a gold. Is that true, by the way? Did the messenger keep moving on a golden bus?
I talked to someone who had to drive her around on this bus all night so her body could not be found easily.
Well, there's a section.
This is,
Set this up for us.
This is the fifth chapter, and Colville is still in Boise. He moves around in the book, but he's not. He hasn't found the girl, of course, and Francine and Wells are not that excited to interact with him, and he's trying to figure out what to do. So he's spending a lot of time decreeing, still searching for the girl, and just trying to get a feeling for what he should do next. So he's about to chant and decree with a candle, I believe, in this motel room. A candle, a match. These were what Colville needed, and he was only half unpacked. He'd moved into this motel room hours ago, and tomorrow he'd be gone again. It was a precaution, this constant movement. It kept the dark forces and spirits confused, so they could not find and surprise him. After all, the messenger herself had often slept in a golden bus that was driven all night, never still. He felt so much inside these days, so much light, as if anything were possible. There were still moments when he tried to explain something and people's expressions showed that they couldn't follow or that they felt sorry for him, when he feared he would begin to cry, or he did start crying just walking down the street or riding a bus. These moments came less and less frequently now, the more he trusted his path, the further he followed it. At last he found a book of matches in a drawer, a candle in the side pocket of his orange frame pack. After lighting the candle, he set it on the seat of the chair. He sat cross-legged on the floor and, placing his hand over his heart, stared at the flame for several seconds. He closed his eyes, visualized the flame in his mind's eye, turned it violet, held it there. It climbed, its points sharp. Gradually it began to flicker. He tried to draw his focus to his heart again to slow his breathing. Yesterday, the flame had not wavered at all. He'd been so certain, he'd sensed that he was being called to the mountains, back to the heart to renew his balance and purify his light. Now he could not hold it steady. The violet flame forked and twisted.
What I wanted to ask you about, a girl disappears, a young girl disappears. You've written about this before. I have to say, I kept coming to my – Elizabeth Smart kept coming to my mind during that first section. The foothills, certain characteristics about that story sort of brought that into mind. I have to ask, were you thinking about that at all?
Yes and no. I think that I've written – I mean, all of my books, not in a way that is important to readers, I think, but for me it's important. They intersect in various ways. And – I think sometimes I've started to write about Boise and then I have to go back to it because that's where things have happened. And Boise stands in my mind for Salt Lake because my relationship to Salt Lake City is so much more complicated and I don't necessarily want to go into every complication.
Yeah.
But in terms of a mid-sized city that has mountains around it, Boise often serves that purpose. This is sort of – it's tied in with my last novel, My Abandonment, which is about – a girl and her father who are living in the wilderness and comes to talk about this abduction or this disappearance in Boise where two sisters are sleeping on a trampoline and one of them is taken. And when I wrote My Abandonment, I was in the early going. I was certainly aware of Elizabeth Smart and I kind of put it out of my mind, but I think it haunts the story because, of course, I was haunted and terrorized by Mormon girls all through. Maybe some of them are listening through my high school years and adolescence. So I was so curious and worried about her and what had happened. And when I wrote My Abandonment, she was still missing and there was really no, I think, hope that she would be found. And by the time the book came out, she had returned and it was a miracle. And, of course, she's an amazing, amazing person. And my book is not really about her, but I think it's aware of her in various ways. So there's a resonance because, I am from there and because I know that area and because I know, people who were involved in the story in various ways.
I wanted to ask you about this idea of energy, generating positive energy, you know, these vibrations. I'm not sure if you've come to believe Peter Rock necessarily in a, you know, supernatural realm or anything, but there is something about this idea of energy that you, that seems compelling for you, that you've come to at least respect in some way. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are a million different ways to talk about it. A lot of times in the actual church, they would talk about karma. And I sort of removed the word karma. I did remove the word karma from my book because people bring different interpretations to it or different prejudices to it. And they also talk about light and dark. But energy, you know, light energy or dark energy or bad energy or good energy, it's just a way to describe a force or a recognition of a force or a desire or a momentum. There's a lot of discussion of momentum. And so, you know, there, you could probably track any number of terms into how to talk about it. But I feel like being aware of where a person, where you gain energy or what makes you feel good, or what has a positive outcome, or being aware of negative energy. I feel like my students now are getting more and more worried about me because I do speak a fair amount when they ask me what to do. I say, well, you know, where do you feel drawn? What's pulling you? Huh. What is the thing that you're most excited about? And I think as you, you know, as I get older, everything that I do is kind of about, you know, what is going to make me happier, not what is going to make people think I'm smarter. And so the idea of energy as a recognition of a force and trying to understand people in terms of how you can best help them is, you know, and how you can help yourself and how you can avoid situations where there isn't necessarily a good outcome. I mean, it's a really complicated and very specific thing. But in terms of vibrations in the air, that's one of the crucial parts of the teachings of the Church Universal and Triumphant. And a lot of the focus on the color violet is because that's the ray where Saint Germain, the Ascended Master, resided. And violet, there's the highest vibration on the color spectrum in the violet spectrum. And that's because their hope was to shake and vibrate bad energy into good energy on the personal level and on the level of the church and on the level of the universe too. And so I don't know. I mean, I can really start going off on this and make people concerned, but I feel that if we, you know, to think hard about what it is that we're doing, if you have no spiritual awareness and think, are we honestly on, you know, a ball of rock that is spinning through this gigantic space? It seems really hard to believe that to me, but it seems to be the case. And so to imagine other possibilities doesn't seem that big a stretch to me. To imagine that there are things around us invisibly at all times that might be trying to help us if we allow them to, that doesn't seem that big a stretch for me. I was in the supermarket the other day with my daughter Ida, who's six now, and she was bending down and looking through the produce at this bare space. And I said, "What is going on? What are you doing?" And she said, "You know, there are things in the air that you can't see between here and this wall." And it was something she was learning in science, but I was like, "You're exactly right. There are particles that we can't see. There's energy there that we can't see."
Peter Rock. His latest book is called The Shelter Cycle. He is going to be in Salt Lake tonight at the King's English Bookshop. He'll be there at 7 o'clock. You can get more details about that by going to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Peter Rock, thank you very much for the time.
Oh, thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, technical direction from Mike Anderson, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.